spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your dollar a month trial today at shopify.com/records.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm well. But how are you? You seem very busy gearing up for COP.
COP26.
How is your, what are you, the pop cop? How is your shadow pop cop role going?
A pot cop, shadow pot cop. We're still some way off as where we need to be as a world. I think it's going to be sort of slightly extraordinary, but I think the whole world is going to descend on Glasgow.
It also feels like the eyes of the world are on this more than any COP. Yes. I can remember. I had a taxi driver talking to me about COP.
Are you serious? You're serious?
Yeah, it seems to be cutting through to people in real life in a way that perhaps people who don't follow these things as closely weren't aware of at previous ones.
Are you saying that the Danish COP, at which I was the RICO representative, it wasn't on the lips of taxi drivers quite in the same way? I think you're probably right. I have to say, I saw a video of myself from the Danish COP, the one I did in the run up to the Danish COP. I mean, I looked a lot younger. I mean, I was a lot younger.
Of course. And on that subject, I've had quite a few people text me. I haven't seen it myself yet, but text me to say how lovely it has been to see your fresh face in the background of that new Labour documentary that they've been showing on the BBC.
Which I haven't watched because I sort of thought it was sort of hard enough to have to go through it without having to watch it. I don't have to relive it again. Do you think I should have participated? I didn't participate in that documentary. I sort of think if you're an active serving politician, it's harder to be a sort of in those things. Do you know what I mean?
Did they ask though?
Well, that is a good point actually. That is a good point. I have sort of news to report, despite the COP and everything. And I should say to the listeners that I fade out in a couple of the interviews this week, and I apologise for that. It's sort of COP and various other things that I've been dealing with. But I have sort of exciting news, which is that my wife borrowed my swimming hat, which I think I have modelled on a previous video, haven't I?
I think so. Yes.
Because we're getting into that time of year when it's sort of the water gets cold. And I'm one of those things where I looked everywhere for my hat and couldn't find it. And then I ordered another hat. And I'm actually quite pleased this has happened because I'm quite excited about my other hat because it's a sort of matching hat with my gloves and it's a brand. I'm not going to mention the brand in case people get funny ideas about me promoting brands, but it's got the matching socks and gloves. And I think it might keep my head a bit warm. But anyway, Justine was like, oh, I borrowed your hat. I was like, where the hell is my hat? Anyway, she said, oh, I borrowed your hat. And I was like, oh, right, okay. But anyway, I'm quite excited. I will report back on this hat. I think this hat could make a big difference.
Okay. Well,
So I've got high hopes. I've got high hopes for this hat.
You've got high hair as well at the moment, I notice. Is that affecting things?
High hair. Well, I'm hoping that the high hair is going, it's the John Kerry look. In fact, John Kerry actually said to me when he was at Kew Gardens, I don't know whether I said this to you, he kept saying to me how grey I looked.
Was he negging you?
Well, I was thinking, okay, John, okay, but he is sort of somewhat older than me. I was like, you're quite grey too. I mean, he's like, gee, you've gone grey. I think he's obviously been watching my Copenhagen videos as well in the run-up to...
Let me ask you a question. Doesn't your wife have a much smaller head than you? I think of her as quite a small-headed person and you as having quite a large cranium. And I say this as somebody myself with a large cranium, which is also quite grey.
Oh, it's interesting. We have a developing and mature relationship, Jeff, but one of the things you've never commented on the size of my head.
It's a large
I mean,
head.
You are actually right about this. I mean, you obviously, you know, you could go into sort of hat fitting, I think.
I remember
because
you having some
right.
issues. There
I'm
was
a large.
One woolly hat that would fit you at one stage.
Oh, that's a good memory. I'm a large. I'm definitely a large. I paused. I kind of hovered over. Was I a medium or a large? And I am indeed a large.
Oh, no, that's definitely a big head there. It's a big head. And Justine, I think, has quite a small head.
Now, should we talk about what we're going to talk about?
Yes. Well, as we said, Ed will be coming and going during this week's episode as he has to go and attend to his duties as pot cop. But we're going to be talking about libraries. And as you'll probably know, here in the UK, public libraries have faced severe cuts for more than a decade. Here's a grim number. Nearly 800 have closed across the country since 2010. And we're going to be talking about the vital role that libraries play in communities and sort of exploring some of the ways that libraries around the world are adapting to changing times and redefining what a library can be. So first, we're going to be talking to sociologist Eric Kleinenberg. Now, Eric is the author of Palaces for the People, which is about his argument that libraries are one of the shared public spaces crucial for building social solidarity and should therefore be a priority for government investment. Then we're going to Denmark, where there's a library.
We're going to Denmark.
We're going to Denmark.
We're going to go to Denmark.
Sadly, not. I mean, it's Aarhus. No. Didn't you go there once?
Aarhus,
in the middle of Denmark.
Did I go to Legoland in Denmark? I think I did.
Did you? You didn't stop at the library while you were there, though.
I didn't stop at the library while I was there. No, not that I remember. I should have done.
You should have done, because this place is spectacular. It's world-renowned. It's called Dock One, and we're going to be asking Maria Ustegård about it and the future of libraries more widely, because she is something she's given a lot of thought to and seen a lot of examples from around the world. And then finally, we're going to be talking to Isabel Hunter from the charity Libraries Connected about the situation here in the UK. It's not all bad news, and we're going to hear about how she thinks that the government should be supporting libraries in the future. And then our cheerful person this week, and I was so disappointed that you didn't get to talk to him, because often on the podcast we'll meet people who worked with you years ago. This was somebody who worked with me years ago.
Wow. Who's that?
Henry Normal. He's fantastic. He's a poet and has been for years one of our finest stand-up poets. Like, he writes really beautiful poetry and he's very funny. But really, for the past couple of decades, he's been better known as a writer and producer. He was one of the people behind The Royal Family and Mrs. Merton and lots of stuff with Steve Coogan, a lot of great British comedy stuff over the past couple of decades. And he's back to his first love, which is poetry. And we're going to be talking to him about his new tour, which is called The Escape Plan. What's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful is that I was in Harrogate yesterday doing a book thing.
A spa town, Harrogate, isn't it?
Yeah. It was fun. It was actually a crowd of all ages. The youngest was 12, came up and I signed his book at the end.
Do you think you've been dragged along?
No, actually. No, my reason to be cheerful is more like a little amusing thing, which is I was getting a very early train this morning to be back in Westminster to vote in Barry Gardiner's private members bill, the fire and rehire bill, important bill. And so I got a really early train, and the very nice man had the reception. He said, well, look, I've made a even though the restaurant's not open, I've done a special takeaway breakfast for you, some fruit and a bacon sandwich.
I knew it was coming.
So I chuckled to myself inwardly.
That's good. That shows healing.
It was completely unconscious. I mean, it was sort of not a sort of, you know, it was not, I hear you like, I gather from the photos, you like bacon sandwiches. I'll leave it as a mystery as to whether I actually ate the bacon sandwich or not and whether there are pictures. What's your reason to be cheerful?
Sprouts are back, I noticed
this
morning.
Not just for Christmas.
Love a Brussels sprout.
They're for life.
They're not just for Christmas. Honestly, as I get older, I can find a lot of joy in waiting for the season of something to roll around, be it the season of a TV show or the season of a particular food. And I felt a level of excitement at seeing Brussels sprouts back in the shops this morning that the 25-year-old me would have been disgusted at. He would have thought, what have you become?
And what will you do with the sprouts?
Do a very good Brussels sprout risotto. I also I like them a little bit blackened with salt. Very simple. Brussels sprouts and miso.
Let me ask you this question. Does Jean eat Brussels sprouts?
I haven't been able to tempt him with sprouts yet. I think it's genetic. I think if you have your DNA tested, it can tell you whether you are genetically predisposed to enjoying a sprout or not.
Okay, I think that is like call my bluff. You know, this, no, I mean, like that is like a 1980s reference. That is
no,
bluff.
I am sure. You are, I'm
you
sure
are Frank,
that we must have.
Actually, you look a bit like Frank Muir. I've suddenly realised, but you are actually Frank Muir. For those of our younger listeners, won't mean much to them. And this is called My Bluff. I do not believe it's like genetic, whether you like Brussels sprouts.
No, I'm telling you, we will have very intelligent genetic scientists who listen to this program who will be able to confirm.
So if you went to one of those genetic analyzing companies, they'd be like, yeah, you've got the sprout-liking gene. I mean, come on. I mean, you must think I was born yesterday, really. I mean,
if somebody could send us an article on that to confirm to my right honourable friend that he's being unnecessarily cynical.
Never mind the Brussels sprouts appearing. That is like an April Fool appearing in October.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
We're going to start by talking to Eric Kleinenberg, who is a professor of sociology at New York University and author of a number of books, including Palaces for the People, How to Build a More Equal and United Society. Eric, hello.
Hello from New York City, where equal and united are very far from reality at the moment.
Well, you're a great believer in the power of shared public spaces, including libraries, which we're going to come on to talk about. But you became interested in this whole area through researching the 1995 Chicago heatwave. Now, I think people might be thinking that that doesn't sound like an obvious way into the subject. So can you tell us a bit about that story and how it inspired you?
I grew up in Chicago, and, you know, Chicago, you know, it's a famous industrial city. It was kind of the great American city, the Manchester of the United States, we like to call it, without the good football. But we also kind of thought of ourselves as a city of neighborhoods and strong social ties where, you know, the civic world works. People know their neighbors. And so I was struck when in the summer of 1995, a fairly short heat wave, it lasted about 3 days, hit Chicago and just tore the city apart. It produced a staggering toll. I mean, thousands in excess of the norm hospitalized, and 739 people died. And I was totally puzzled by this event, you know, as a child of the city. And I went back and I started asking people what had happened. And at first, you know, I got these strange responses from people who were wondering whether it was really real. You know, they were literally questioning whether this disaster had happened, even though there had been something like 10 refrigerated trucks storing the bodies in the center of the city. But then I wanted to understand, like, well, who died and where did they die? And I got interested in this whole question about public spaces, because what I observed is that the neighborhoods in Chicago that were really deadly were not just, you know, poor and black and segregated, which is what you would expect in a crisis like that in Chicago. They were also abandoned, depleted. They had lost population. They had lost their diners and coffee shops and grocery stores and churches and neighborhood organizations. They really felt bombed out. And I knew this because I also found a whole set of neighborhoods that were, you know, black and segregated and poor. On paper, they looked vulnerable in every way. You would have predicted they'd have massive deaths, but they turned out to be the safest places in Chicago, actually safer than the wealthier neighborhoods up on the north side. And the reason is because they had a robust, you know, what I came to think of as social infrastructure, this set of physical places that can support our interactions if we maintain them and build them well. And that really turned me on to the fact that social infrastructure matters in ways we typically don't understand.
So that's a phrase that we hear used in a couple of different contexts. So when you talk about social infrastructure, what are the specific things you're talking about? And explain to us how libraries are a part of that.
I'm glad you said that, because it reminds me that the US and the UK are, you know, two nations separated by a common language. When you talk about social infrastructure, you're referring to the health sector and the education sector and things like that. I have a more kind of precise, kind of, I don't know, idiosyncratic way of defining it. So when I talk about social infrastructure, I mean the physical places that shape our interactions. And the argument I make in Palaces for the People is that when you design social infrastructure well, when you invest in it, when you build it well, when you maintain it, you get all kinds of returns to collective life, to democracy. It encourages the building of relationships. It supports bridging relationships across groups. It can help to build trust. And it obviously builds kind of the fundamental kinds of social support that keep people alive in a heat wave or whatever crisis is coming next. At the same time, if we neglect social infrastructure, imagine you live in a society where they said, you know, we don't have money for libraries anymore. We're going to shut them down. We're going to sell them off to condo developers. You would have diminished returns to collective life. You know, people would be less likely to use them, more likely to get on their phones, more likely to kind of shrink from the public and retreat into their safe houses, you know, which I think are part of the problem.
Well, it's sort of interesting because in some ways it feels like a symptom of the modern age, that if we are all staring at our screens a bit more, we're doing a lot of online shopping, the physical places that where we're mixing with people other than our immediate social circle, it seems to be given less and less thought.
I think that our experience in the pandemic has really given us a wake-up call, because we now understand what life is like when we're reduced to face-to-screen interactions all the time. You know, we know what remote life is like. And there are virtues of remote life. I mean, it's not a horrible thing to skip the office on, you know, some days. But the truth is, I think most of us feel like we have lost something that makes us fundamentally human.
We'll come on to some of your favorite examples of libraries, I'm sure. But just more generally, what does a library need to be to meet your definition of social infrastructure? Because sometimes they can be places that are used by very specific sections of the community, but perhaps not that widely used.
So I'm a scholar. I teach at New York University. And a few years ago, I was visiting Oxford for an academic meeting. And I wanted to go see this extraordinary library, Bodleian Library, Bodleian. I always get it wrong. But it's whatever it is, it's a damn impressive library they have there. And I wanted to go in. And they wouldn't let me in the place. You know, I didn't have the right ID card. I was not an Oxford citizen, student, faculty. That's an amazing institution, and thank goodness we have it. Scholarly libraries are, you know, so important. But it's not exactly the kind of library that I'm thinking of here. I'm referring to public libraries. And the great virtue of public libraries, and not all societies have them, the U.S. does, the U.K. has a diminishing supply, is that they're open. They are accessible. They are free for everyone who wants to enter in. You know, that they're staffed by these magical people called librarians. And their job is to ask, you know, how can I help you when you walk in? And that doesn't mean, you know, can I get you a grande latte, you know, or a matcha tea? It means, like, how can I actually help you? They're not trying to sell you something. What I love about libraries is, and my book is called Palaces for the People, because that was Andrew Carnegie's, you know, phrase for what a library could do. And the notion is that the library should exalt you. It should lift you up. You know, the classic Carnegie libraries, you generally have to go up a couple of stairs or a ramp to get in, because they are literally taking you up off the street, off ground level. And they have, you know, big ceilings and big windows. And the notion is that a great library should dignify the user, so that when you walk in, you feel like your humanity has been acknowledged, that you are being respected fundamentally as a person. And what's so special about that is there are very few places in society that do that to us these days. And so I think what happens in libraries, and what makes them such tremendous social infrastructure, is that they welcome people of all ages, of all stations, ethnic group, racial identity, social class, and they provide a range of programs that teach us how to be citizens and how to live together. You don't have to go to the library because you want to befriend the other people at your table. Sometimes you know, they're on the machine that you want to use. Sometimes they've got the book that you want. It's very annoying to have people like that. But they teach us, just like riding on the tube teaches us this, you know, how to live with other people.
And on to examples. I wondered if you could tell our listeners about the libraries in Brooklyn that connected pensioners. In a way that you might not expect in a library. I think it's so fantastic.
I discovered that at the Brooklyn Library System, they have invented this thing they call Library Lanes. And Library Lanes is a brilliant idea. They basically have set up a virtual bowling league for pensioners. And people have not just the kind of grand libraries in New York, like the one that you've seen on movies with the big lions and granite at the front. There's also all these branch libraries, you know, the neighborhood libraries. And a whole bunch of neighborhood libraries in Brooklyn have their own bowling league. And if you join as a pensioner, you get a bowling jersey, You have a regular time, like once a week, you go on Thursday morning. The librarian hooks up a flat screen television to an Xbox or Wii or some, you know, some gaming device. And the library teams compete against other library teams. And man, it was as good as a Chelsea football match. You know, it was just like really amazing to be in this room. And I am a diehard football fan, so I don't say that lightly. It really like it felt amazing to be in the room with them. And one reason is that the people who come, they're the people who are most likely to die alone in the heat wave. You know, they're older people. They often live alone. They're disconnected from a lot of institutions. And the library is a place that connects them to other people. And so the question for us, you know, sometimes I think when we deal with social problems, we think like, how can we change the culture? You know, how can we change the way people think about things and behave? Well, and we do it without realizing that we're all context dependent. You know, that if we have to create situations, and one way to create situations is by building amazing places. If we don't have the places like, you know, libraries and playgrounds, you know, for families and athletic fields that are accessible and schools that have, you know, yards that are pleasant, things like that. If we don't have that, you don't have the elements you need to create a civil society and an open society and a place where people trust each other and trust the government to do the right thing. And what happens is people turn on the very idea of an open society. They turn on the very idea of democracy. They start to distrust this whole game.
Because it can feel here sometimes like a lot of people have given up on the noble idea of libraries as a thing of the past and see them as a bit of an anachronism in the digital age, even though there's this fondness for the library. What is the key to thinking about libraries of the future, to understanding what they can be as a public space, as social infrastructure? What is the thing that will unlock for people how to think about libraries?
I mean, I would say, first of all, go to one and see what's happening. I mean, I can't say what's happening in British libraries at the moment because, you know, your society has really assaulted your libraries. I mean, the divestment of libraries in England is a national scandal. And I mean, literally, when I speak around the world about libraries, exhibit A for what not to do is England. But, you know, to see libraries, you know, have their budgets slashed, to see them depend on volunteer labor because, you know, funding for librarians is gone, to see them literally be sold off and developed as, you know, private market goods, where it's a scandal. It's a scandal. In contrast, you know, look at what they just did in Oslo. You know, look at what they just did in Helsinki. Look at what they just did in Calgary or Edmonton or Vancouver or Austin, Texas. I mean, there are societies that are building glorious libraries as testaments to what social democracy can produce. But societies that are decent societies invest in ordinary people. You know, they invest in working class people. You know, they invest in multi-ethnic communities. They invest in neighborhoods. They create, you know, they create opportunities. And that is literally what you see, I think, in libraries, you know, more than any other institution.
Well, you are a tremendous champion. It's been so interesting to talk to you. Eric, thank you very much.
Hey, I really appreciate it. Take care.
So I'm delighted to say that we're now joined by Marie Ostergaard, who is Library Director of Aarhus Public Libraries in Denmark. How's my pronunciation of Aarhus?
That's pretty good, actually. Thank you.
How about his Ostergaard?
It's a good English pronunciation of my last name, so I'm fine with that.
What's the real? Go on, give us the what I should have said, Marie.
So my last name in English, in Danish, is Østergaard.
Østergaard.
Yeah, and the name of the city is Aarhus.
Aarhus. Now we're talking about your incredible library, which is not so much a library, but definitely a sort of palace for the people. But Jeff wants me to ask you about the robot car park.
Well, that's funny how there are actually quite a lot of men who are very interested in that robot car park. Yeah, it's a big tourist attraction. No, no kidding. It is actually quite great. It is an opportunity to have a lot more parking spaces in a very small place underground. So we have 20 car elevators.
Now, talk to us about the library itself. It's called, I'm going to do a bad pronunciation again. Pronounce the name of the library.
Dock One
Library.
You could have got that, Ed.
I know.
D-O-K-K.
Honestly, I'd lost my confidence.
Lost Jeff. Your confidence.
Completely.
What is the vision behind Dock One and what kinds of things can visitors do at the library?
Well, you started saying by it's a, that it's a palace for the people, which I'm obviously very thrilled about, but I would definitely say that it is a library. I don't use phrases like it's not just a library. It is a library because this is what we believe a library should be. It's a place where you come, you can borrow books, you can read, you can do all the traditional library stuff, but it's also a place for debates, for meetings, for performances, for maker activities, laser cutting, authors telling stuff, but also just regular people sharing with each other the knowledge that they have. We also have citizen services in Lot 1, which is where you get come to get your passport and your driver's license. There's a cafe, big auditoriums, and there are also spaces where people can borrow rooms, auditoriums, meeting rooms for their own purposes.
And how important is the... I mean, the library is the core, obviously. I'm not about to say it's not just a library. Well, I am about to say it's not just a library, but it is a library and other things too. Why?
All the things that we are is what a library is. A library is about knowledge. Library is about learning. It's about experience. It's about culture. And, you know, in the old days, all of these things came in books, right? This was a way for people to get access to all of these things were through free books in libraries. But today, knowledge and learning and culture comes in many different formats and very much through people sharing with each other. So that's why we've enlarged the different opportunities of what a library should and can provide.
And talk to us about the story behind the design process, because I think there was a 10-year process which you were very involved in of planning Dock One.
And it's beautiful. I mean, it's the most incredible looking building.
So the whole idea was basically to create not a space for books, but a space for people. Not saying that we don't have books. We have tons of books. And books are also part of this. But it's a space for people, and it has to take its starting point in people's needs, because that's what public libraries should do. So we spent 10 years making user involvement processes, co-creation with citizens, co-creation with partners around what should this library be and what would be the right library for Aarhus.
Talk to us about this notion that there's both a community centre and a democratic space. What does that mean, a democratic space?
So basically, the way we look at libraries is that it's one big mashup. It's a big framework around tons of different kinds of activities, not necessarily carried out by the library, but also by our partners and by the citizens. So for instance, in Dock One, you'll find 140 different programs a month, and 50% of those are carried out by or with partners, partners being also groups of citizens, right? So the diversity of the different activities going on in Dock One is enormous and a lot bigger than if it was just us. So when we talk about the library as a democratic space, it's basically a place where we support participatory culture. So when I talk about democracy, I'm not necessarily talking about voting or political processes. I'm talking about participatory democracy. How can we as libraries help people be and stay competent in their own lives and have influence on the community and society that they're a part of?
So what does that look like? If I was a citizen of Aarhus, how is the library helping me engage with and stay connected with the democracy?
Many different ways. You can access in the physical premises, you can access through our different digital platforms. And so we have a lot of what we called unprogrammed spaces in Dock One, which means flexible spaces that can be redone to fit the need of, for instance, if you want to come in and do a choir singing, something like that, we will find the space for you and we'll set up a program around it. So you can come and do stuff for your own group, but you can also come and do stuff that way you share it with others. And that's the beauty of it. So we try to take it out in the open spaces so that people will stumble upon something they didn't necessarily expect in a library.
Eric was saying that he thinks of England in particular, maybe the United Kingdom, as an example of how not to run your library system. How important is what the central government decide in Denmark with regards to libraries as opposed to local municipalities?
We have a library legislation, and obviously that is a national one, and obviously that is very important for libraries, even though they're funded by the municipalities. I think that a national government sets a tone for the value of institutions. And I think that is the tone that the municipalities lean against when they're then defining how to spend the money in the municipality. So I think it's quite important. I'm sorry to agree with Eric on this one, because actually I think the UK have had some enormously successful libraries over many, many years, and it's just been a really hard decline on that. But there are some really amazing libraries in the UK as well still. And I think some of them have managed to reinvent themselves. The Manchester Public Library is really amazing. The Idea Stores in London, a reinvention of what a library is. So there are great examples of how libraries also in the UK managed to move forward, even though they're not very well supported nationwide.
And you also run an international conference about the future of libraries. What elements of digital life mean that we have to reframe how we have to think about the library?
I want to say that libraries for me are both digital and physical. So we have ebook lending digitally in every part of the country for free. But I think we also have to acknowledge that what happens in the physical spaces are unique. In libraries, that's where you meet across all the different personal backgrounds that you have in a non-commercial space. And for us, that's something that we have to keep focusing on, because that's really important for our coherence in society.
We collect all the ideas that we hear on the podcast into what will hopefully be a manifesto for a utopia in the future. We call it the Jeffocracy. If we were to make you Minister for Libraries, if you think about what governments can do straight away to transform what libraries are able to offer to their communities, what would you do? What would you implement on day one? Is it just resource? Is it just a money tap? Or is there more that government can be doing?
No, it's not just resources and money. It is really about intent. I think I would demand that libraries would create spaces for meetings and debates. It's actually part of the library legislation in some countries. We're very high on the trustworthy scale. If you ask people who are trustworthy, libraries are really up there. And that's because we're not trying to sell people anything. We're actually trying to make people better at their own lives. So why not use this for the best purpose at all, namely bridging people and knowledge, people and ideas, and people and people. I would also give them a shitload of money, to be honest. Yeah.
You've got the job, and I'm desperate to come and see that Dock One. It's a spectacular building. I don't even drive, but I want to see the robot car park. Thank you so much for telling us about what you've been doing there in Aarhus, Marie. Thank you.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, we're going to finish our chat by trying to find some reasons to be cheerful here in the UK. And to help us with that, we have Isabel Hunter, who is Chief Executive of Libraries Connected. Hello.
Hi. Hello. Thanks for asking me onto your podcast.
Well, thank you for coming on. And I say to try and find us some reasons to be cheerful. It's because talking to both Marie and Eric, you get the impression that at some point the UK was a bit of a beacon when it came to libraries. And then in recent years, obviously with austerity, things have become a bit more difficult. So why don't you just start by telling us about Libraries Connected and the work you do, and you can show us that there's something to be hopeful about going on here that might not be initially visible.
Yeah, so Libraries Connected, we're the membership body for public libraries in England, Wales, Northern Ireland and the Crown Dependencies. We're also funded by Arts Council as a sector support organisation. So we offer training and development to libraries, and we try and get in more funding, we advocate for them. And I've just come back from our annual two-day conference, and I've come back absolutely bursting with cheerfulness.
Well, that's so interesting. So we've been talking about the austerity here in the UK and the cuts that libraries have faced. And of course, we're coming off the back of the pandemic. Where is this optimism coming from? Where is this cheerfulness coming from?
Do you know, we had some really powerful presentations at our seminar about some really, you know, these crushing social problems that we faced coming out of the pandemic. So we heard about destitution, digital exclusion, the gap in literacy levels for children. We heard about loneliness, you know, some of these really massive problems that the pandemic's made worse and made those gaps bigger. But what's made me cheerful, the library people coming out of those sessions were not downcast. They were really kind of fired up, and they were all saying, gosh, there's so much my library could do to help here. I'm going to go back at the end of this, you know, end of this conference. I'm going to go back to the ranch and I'm going to get plans in place.
And can you talk to us a little bit about who the people are in the community who you feel perhaps, I know the libraries are for everybody, but who need it most, who perhaps get a bit overlooked when we're talking about libraries?
I think that's, you know, kind of the real challenge at the heart of library work. Libraries aren't just about the buildings and the books and the resources. They are about the people and the connections and that sort of social, like community building that they do. So again, really interesting in the pandemic how libraries went about that. You know, they couldn't necessarily visit housebound people to deliver books. So they instead started picking up the phone and making keeping touch calls. There was one library that started a letter writing project to people isolated at homes. And really, you know, really moving stories back from that period. So one lady said she sat down and cried after the library had phoned her up. Because she couldn't believe that somebody had remembered her, you know, in the dark first days of lockdown when she felt forgotten, someone had remembered her. And another chap whose elderly mother had died, and he lived with her, and he had no one else to talk to about it, about his bereavement. So the library started phoning him every single day just for a chat so he could go through that process with them. So I think libraries are really, really good at knowing their communities and thinking about people in more need.
Do you think there's a bigger job of work to be done in getting the public to think about libraries differently? Because I think, you know, probably a lot of people still think of them as very quiet places where you go to bury your head in the books, and you still have that association of the shushing librarian. How do we go about getting people to think differently about these great resources that can be at the heart of their town or city?
Yeah, you're right. I think it's a very powerful word, isn't it, library? So people do have this stereotype. And sometimes I wonder when did this stereotype actually exist? Because actually talking to some people who've worked in libraries a long time, you know, even back in the olden days, so someone was talking about a circus skills workshop that they ran in a library in the 80s. So, you know, the kind of shush library, I think, has been long gone. But yeah, we've been doing lots of discussion about could a national marketing campaign help, you know, come and see your library, see what's going on. So I think it's a really big challenge, isn't it, how you flip over an idea that maybe was unfair to start with.
Well, we're talking about you know, national schemes, something we've not really touched upon is the role of government in all this. Now, we've mentioned the cuts that libraries have faced over the past 10 years or more, but what could government be doing to better support public libraries?
The challenge for public libraries and government is a kind of a bit of a structural challenge. They're part of local government, 90% of their funding comes from local government, and then they generate about 10% through other sources. So you know, embedded there in local government, which in some ways makes them quite resilient. So although we have had all these cuts, we haven't lost any whole library services.
Is it something we have a right to as citizens? Is there anything sort of enshrined anywhere that there will be this many libraries per population in any given local area?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got the 1964 Public Libraries Act. So it's a responsibility of local authorities to offer, in the famous words of the Act, comprehensive and efficient library service, whatever that means, to local people. But I think one of the challenges at the national level, libraries are under the arm of Department of Culture, Media and Sport, which isn't one of the more powerful government departments. You know, be absolutely brilliant if the role of libraries minister within government was more powerful and could be more successful at persuading government departments, persuading them that, look, you can deliver your agendas around whatever it is, health or education, social mobility, economic growth. You can deliver those if you put some investment into the library network. You know, we've got this amazing network, this amazing infrastructure. Relatively modest squirts of central government funding could really turbocharge that network.
Well, what if we give you that role in our podcast Utopia of the Jeffocracy? There you are, day one. What do you do?
So I'd get the secretaries of state from some of the other key departments, so health, education, local government, business. I'd get them around the table and I'd say, right, you each need to put X million pounds into libraries because health, libraries can really help sort out loneliness or help prevent that. They can help keep older people active. So that's going to save you, you know, a massive amount of money. It's going to help you meet those agendas. So I'd work round the table like that. And then I'd have a big hat in the middle of the table. So before they were allowed to leave the room, they'd have put into the hat the amount of money that they were going to channel through libraries. And then hopefully, 2 years down the line, they'd realise that that investment was well worthwhile because it's bearing dividends in the amount of the social impact it's having and a positive impact on people's lives.
Fantastic. Well, I'll send Ed out to get the big hat then. That's all we need. Thank you so much. As I said, we feel a little bit bleak about the situation in the UK talking to both Marie and Eric, but you've rectified that. There's some good stuff going on.
I think there's just such innovation and determination. And I think because, there has been costs, austerity's been... You know, it's grim, isn't it? It's horrible having to operate like that. But I think we need to look past that. And I think in the UK, we can be massively proud of library practice and library work. Every time you pass a library, you need to feel a surge of pride and enormously cheerful.
Brilliant. Isabel, thanks so much for talking to us.
Great, thank you.
So I'm conscious that I was somewhat the silent partner in some of those interviews. What did you think?
I'm really convinced at the role that libraries can play. And, this is Eric uses the phrase social infrastructure to mean the shared public spaces and the roles they play in our communities. I think libraries can be really important in that. And it's something we've touched on in different ways in a lot of episodes, I think. But if you think about how we're living online a lot more and shopping online and about how, remember we talked about town centres, and how do you maintain a social cohesion? I think if we start thinking about libraries in the way that Marie and Eric was talking about, and in the way that Isabel are saying, there's no shortage of ideas for that in this country, I think libraries can be really important in giving our communities some sense of cohesion.
I think this issue of public space, I think you're completely right, is just way underestimated. Good quality public space gives people an impression of the extent to which they're valued by the society, by the country. Do you know what I mean?
If so many of the places we used to be mixing with each other, and mixing with each other gives us empathy and a sense of being part of a society and a local community, if so many of those have vanished or the nature of them have changed, then what replaces them? And Marie used this phrase, a non-commercial space, a place for you to use and be with people that isn't trying to make money out of you is a great thing.
Email us, reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter @cheerfulpodcast or search for our Facebook page, Reasons to be Cheerful Podcast.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Well, for our cheerful person this week, I'm delighted to bring you someone who I've been a great fan of and been lucky enough to know for a long, long time. It's a name that will be incredibly familiar to you, perhaps unwittingly watching the credits of loads of TV shows. If you are a listener to Radio 4, you will have enjoyed the excellent programmes he's done on there over the past few years. And if you go way back, you'll remember his prowess as a live performer in a cardigan back in the early 90s and perhaps even before that. It's Henry Normal. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for coming on. And I'm so disappointed that Ed has gone. He's not quite AWOL. He's owl. He's absent with leave.
Do you know, I'm sure he's doing very, very important things.
I think you're probably right. I think he will certainly be labouring under the illusion that he is. But I really wanted him to say hello to you, because usually what happens is we'll talk to somebody who knew Ed when he was like a young lad working in the Treasury.
Oh, yes.
And yet you knew me when I was sort of like a drunken young boy in Manchester.
Well, yes, not always drunk.
No, often though. It wasn't great.
You know, the thing I remember most about you is your passion and enthusiasm. You always, and funnily enough, this obviously is about cheerfulness as much as anything, this podcast. And, you know, that's what I remember of you.
Oh, that's so nice, because in my head I always think, oh, I think Henry probably thought I was a bit of a nuisance.
No.
Because Henry worked with Caroline Ahern and Craig Cash on the Mrs. Merton show. And when I was out of work, they were very kind and gave me a job fetching Asti Spumanti and Benson and Hedges for Caroline back in the day. But you always seemed a bit like the grown-up. Like, you know, Craig and Caroline would be constantly making prank phone calls or faxing people scatological drawings. And I always felt like they would never have got any work done if it hadn't been for you.
Well, yes, I'm slightly older than Caroline and Craig. And I had a grounding when I was in my early 20s of working in an office. So I've always been geared towards getting something done.
Did you ever feel like they treated you like the teacher?
No, I thought of, and I still do, think of Caroline and Craig and Steve and Dave Gorman as brothers and sisters. There was a great sense of community. You've just sparked a memory. I do remember one time I had to be quite strict with them, because on the day we was filming one of the Mrs. Merton shows, they went for a foot massage, Caroline and Craig, which took about 2 hours. So that was 2 hours out of a recording day. Usually they skived off on non-essential days. If Caroline didn't want to write, as you probably remember, we'd go shopping.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I know that when we did the first episode of The Royal Family, which Craig Cash and Caroline and I wrote, because we're from council estates, we were able to actually write it authentically, and if we hadn't, it wouldn't have been popular. And it was basically Caroline saying, what does your parents say, you know, what does your dad say? And we wrote down, I mean, a lot of those for that first series is actual verbatim what mums and dads have said. And you'll probably remember fairly early on in the first episode the line, who's been phoning Aberdeen? And, you know, all our dads were very careful with money.
When it got to the screen, the warmth is so obvious. Yeah. But it doesn't, you know, it's shown, not told in that way.
Well, it is. And they tried to make it something they could understand. So they said to us, can we have a plot in the second episode? And we said, it's not a plot in the first episode. What are you talking about? Because it was all done in real time. So if you made a cup of tea, the scene would take as long as it takes to make a cup of tea, because, you know, it was done. So it was half an hour out of the life of a family that lived on a, well, Withenshaw, essentially. And they were trying desperately to put it into terms and be going, oh, I've not got my trousers on, and the vicar's coming for tea. And you go, well, put your trousers on and say hello to the vicar. It's not a problem.
I remember Caroline saying, where do these people live? Coincidence City.
Yes, yeah.
And what about that question of gatekeepers, though, Henry? If like, there was a great quote that I remember hearing, and I you know, I'm sort of both paraphrasing it and I can't attribute it, but it was along the lines of, like, a lot of television is what people who've been to university think that people who haven't been to university want to watch.
I don't know whether you know, but incidentally, when Steve Coogan and I set up Baby Cow, I think we were the first working class comedy producers to set up a company that hadn't been to Oxford or Cambridge.
I bet. Yeah. Yeah. And what a company, you know, it was, and I guess continues to be. I know you're no longer involved, but like Mighty Boosh, Gavin and Stacey, Alan Partridge, and trying to think what else, Nighty Night, Marion and Jeff, which I loved so much.
Yeah. Well, I did. So I created it with Steve, and I did 17 and a half years. And then 5 years ago, I retired from television spend more time with the family, as politicians would say. And
now you're sick of them.
No, right.
So you're going out on tour.
Well, we have had lockdown. I mean, we've seen more of family. I'm sure everybody's seen more of family and more of their home than they bargained for.
Let's talk about the tour then, because presumably you must have had the itch to perform during those years you were producing all these shows.
Well, I didn't have time, Jeff. The thing was that if you probably remember, when I worked with Caroline and Craig, I also was writing for Steve Coogan at the time. So I'd be writing at weekends, I'd be writing in my lunch hour, I'd be writing at night. If you think of all those early Paul Carf and the Coogan's Run and the Tony Farino and all those, I was writing those at the same time as the Mrs. Merton's. And the
you would be amazed at how often Tony Farino's, which is a character of Steve Coogan, how often the song Other Men's Wives is in my head.
Oh, right. Well,
it's stuck in my head all the time, that thing.
Then when I started Baby Cow with Steve, it was just full on. I mean, we made 450 television programmes and over a dozen films in 17 and a half years. So, you know, we went from nothing to being the leading supplier of comedy to the BBC within about 5 years.
Which leaves no time for live performance. When I first knew you and knew of you, you'd be like a mainstay at festivals doing poetry/comedy around Manchester. And I always loved it. It seemed like a funny time because there was you, there was Lem Sissé, John Hegley. I don't know if he's your nemesis or not, because you're sort of in the same.
No,
space. Not your nemesis.
I don't have nemesis. I love John Egley. John Egley's, I think, probably the funniest poet in the world.
Yeah, and he's brilliant.
He's great, and Lem is like a brother to me, and we still keep in touch. And I saw him recently when he was the director of the Brighton Festival, so we spent some time together. I mean, Lem's become an international poet. God bless him.
I was trying to think how to explain, for people who know the name but haven't seen you or heard the Radio 4 show, how to explain what it is to see Henry Normal on. I know it's an awful thing to ask you to put you on the spot. Now, I used to go see you 20-odd years ago when, you know, as I said, a man with a cardigan who I think had like lots of warm, lovely, very funny observations about just the minutiae of life and love. I think since then, you've incorporated a lot of your family story into it. I can see, I think you're sitting in front of a painting done by your son, Johnny.
You've told
stories about your family in the Radio 4 show. So is that what people can expect, a combination of that kind of funny stuff of life and then more of your story from your family as the years have gone on?
Well, yes. What I try to do is a bit like the radio shows, is I pick a theme. Obviously we're talking about escape, so the escape into creativity is part of the theme. The next show I'm going to be doing for Radio 4 is a normal aging, so there's some stuff about aging, and then there's just a mix of jokes and stories and poems about everything: love, family, home, dreams, everything that sort of gives a rounded view of life. And I love doing that, but I can't sort of become a tribute band to myself, just sort of do all the old stuff. I have to keep writing new material and expressing myself with new material. So the 22 dates I've got, the show at the beginning won't be the same show as the show at the end.
Henry, it's such a treat to know that you're back out on tour again. I'd really love to come and see you. And I just want to say to people that you're guaranteed a special evening. It's funny, but Henry's something else. It's really special. So it's a joy to talk to you again after all these years.
Thank you very much. And to you.
Apologies from Ed.
That's all right. I'll catch him when he's back in Downing Street.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, we're in the outro.
How did you think Sarah did last week?
Brilliantly.
Did you listen?
Yeah, I thought I'm surplus to requirements.
She obviously was a somewhat last-minute stand-in, and she was worried she was going to take the whole podcast down and people would be angry at her for being on it, and she felt completely ill-adept to being here.
No, she did really well.
So have you listened to our new podcast yet, then?
No. What is it?
We're doing a Succession after-show podcast called Firecrotch and Normcore. Are
you serious?
Yeah, where we talk about that week's episode of Succession and read out listener email, because we're obsessed with it.
How's it going?
Really well, because other people are obsessed with it as well. So we're getting great email from people, and we're sharing all these theories and queries. I even saw your former colleague Alistair Campbell wrote a big piece about Succession.
Was it called Firecrotch and
Normcore? Do you know who I mean if I say Tom and Shiv?
Yes.
So it is an insult that is directed at Tom and Shiv from the obnoxious middle brother Roman in one of the episodes.
That's so funny.
For the cover art, we've recreated a photograph of them, which I am quietly quite pleased with.
That's really good. I'm going to listen to that, Jeff. That sounds like incredibly entertaining.
It's fun. Should we thank our guests? We probably should. Thanks to Eric Kleinenberg, to Marie Ustegor. Is that how she said to say it, Ed?
Yes.
I think your pronunciation was very much a 6 out of 10.
Oh, no, it's a generous 6.
And thanks to the wonderful Isabel Hunter as well, and great to talk to Henry Normal. His tour is called The Escape Plan. Emma Corsham produces our podcast. Joel Pierce does all the research and finds such great people for us to talk to, supported by Joe Kenyon at Goldfish. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. Ed Seed composed the music. James Deacon made our idents, and the artwork was designed by
Henry Cole.
He's been Big Ed.
He's been a genetically engineered sprout.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.